From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. On the south side of Chicago, there are telltale signs of a good barbecue. For example, the distinctive indoor smoker that resembles a huge fish tank. Or perhaps it's the steady trickle of people hauling overstuffed, steaming foam containers through the snow back to their car, where the contents will be swiftly devoured. With barbecue fever sweeping the country, you'd think Southside barbecue would be poised for national exposure. The truth is that half of the city knows about it. The other half has no idea. Here's food writer Kevin Pang.
People associate Chicago with deep dish pizza and Italian beef and cheese caramel popcorn. To my mind, Southside Chicago barbecue is one of the great culinary exports of our city, but it's a culinary export that few people actually know about it. And even within the city of Chicago, I'd say half of the city has never even tried it.
Kevin Pang recently wrote an article for Savoir Magazine about this important yet obscure barbecue tradition.
Southside barbecue is cooked in this very strange, curious-looking glass box. And we call it an aquarium smoker. And inside this glass box, there are mostly rib tips and hot sausage links. And underneath all that is wood fire and just smoke billowing out of it. And as far as I know, it's a Chicago institution. It's a Chicago original. And you really can't find it outside the city, with the exception of probably one place I know in Memphis. But it's really indigenous to Chicago, and it's a really unique type of barbecue. And really, not a lot of people outside the city know about it.
Okay, so first let's talk about that aquarium smoker. I would imagine that it developed because of the weather.
Right. Chicago, as you know, it's a very cold place. It's cold, I would say, about 7 months out of the year. And also, there's not a lot of outdoor spaces as well here in Chicago. It's a very compact space. And especially when we're talking about the south side of Chicago, it's just not very efficient, I suppose, of cooking outdoors. And so you have these aquarium smokers, which have these huge chimneys that jut out high through the roof. This is one way of cooking barbecue indoors using wood fire smoke. And I think that's really the key here. It's not using any sort of like pellets or using any sort of like gas powered smoker. This is using real live fire smoke. You know, it's a really original and idiosyncratic form of barbecue that you really can't find anywhere else.
How do the pitmasters tame the fire?
It's really interesting because they are standing by the fire outside this box, and they're almost always holding in one hand a pair of tongs, metal tongs, to flip the meats. And on the other hand, they're holding a garden hose, and they are constantly spraying water inside this wood fire. And you just need to know about this aquarium smoker. There are no knobs. There are no automatic dials that you can set a temperature to. This is essentially just a glass box that contains wood fire and smoke. Everything is done manually. You're spraying water to create the smoke, to create the steam. And then if you want the temperature to rise, you just open the door underneath, and so you have more oxygen flowing through the fire. That increases the temperature. And if you want the temperature to be a little bit lower, you close the doors, and then the less oxygen means less heat. This is one of those types of barbecue that really requires many, many hours, if not many years, of knowing the ins and outs and idiosyncrasies to be able to master it.
So if we were to go into one of these places, what is the go-to order?
So you would go to a Southside Chicago barbecue joint, and most of the time you would be separated from the cashier taking your order with this carousel that is made with like bulletproof material. Sadly, in the south side of Chicago, there's still a lot of violence that's happening here. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so ubiquitous to have your barbecue served through these carousels. Nevertheless, you go there, and they would have a number of items, but mostly you would find our rib tips. And rib tips are the sort of the knobby end of the spare rib. The spare rib is comprised of what's called a St. Louis cut and the rib tip itself. And so rib tips, which were really once seen as a throwaway cut, but is really the preferred meats you find on the south side of Chicago, because A, it's cheap, and B, there's a lot of cartilage, which means it's sort of on the fattier end. And there's really a lot of tactile pleasures of biting through them, throwing the whole rib tip in your mouth and kind of maneuvering your jaw and your tongue and your teeth and to extract those, you know, bits of cartilage. It's fatty, it's, you know, smoky and delicious and meaty, and it's a lot of fun. So rib tips are one thing. And the other thing about Chicago Southside Barbecue are the hot links. These are these bulbous foot-long length of pork sausage. A lot of these pitmasters would first smoke it for an hour or so just to really infuse it with that smoke flavor. And a lot of them, they actually flash fry it right before they serve it. So when it comes out of the deep fryer, the casing is super crackly. And, you know, it's really fun and appealing to bite through. And you would get both the rib tips and the hot links. And it's called here colloquially the tip link combo. You'd say, I'd like a large tip link combo, sauce on the side. That's the order I always get when I'm on the south side. I'd say tip link order, sauce on the side, and they know exactly what I want.
And what is the sauce?
Very much the type of sauce that you would find in Memphis or Kansas City. It's very much a tomato base sauce. It's sort of on the sweeter end of the spectrum, I would say. But then you would also pick up a lot of vinegar as well, and you would get a little bit of spice at the end. This actually makes a lot of sense. You know, in researching for the story, I talked to a lot of barbecue scholars. I also spoke to a lot of African-American historians, and they told me that a lot of the African-Americans who moved up to Chicago, you know, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, essentially during the Great Migration, a lot of them would also stop in Kansas City as well before coming to Chicago. So that's why you get that sort of Kansas City influence in this particular sauce.
Okay, so let's talk about the man that you focus on in your article in Savoir, a man named Gary Kennebrew. Tell me a little bit about him, where he came from, and how he got into this business.
Gary Kennebrew's life story is very much the life story of a lot of African Americans who live in Chicago. Family came up during the Great Migration. He grew up in Gadsden, Alabama, lived in a house with six other siblings, and his family decided that they wanted a better life. And so with opportunities up north by the Great Lakes, his father found a job working at a steel mill, and they all moved up to the south side of Chicago and had a really prosperous, great sort of middle-class life. Went to college, worked in corporate America. He was working for a hair care company. And after that was sold to L'Oreal, Gary decided that he wanted to, pursue other things that he always wanted to pursue. He did that by opening up a car detailing shop and a car wash. And what was really interesting was that the car wash was right next to this really famed barbecue joint called Barber Ann's Barbecue. Barber Ann's had this pitmaster named Max Sevier. And Max Sevier, to my mind, is one of the great pitmasters, if not the greatest pitmaster in Chicago of the last 25 years. So Gary and Mac would develop this friendship. They were both deacons in their church. They both grew up in the South. They both came up during the Great Migration. They had a lot of things in common. But most importantly, they were both big fans of barbecue. So Mac would essentially adopt Gary as his godson. So they became really, really close to the point where when Mac decided to open up his own barbecue restaurant, he decided to split from Barber Ann's. Gary actually took over as the manager at this Barber Ann's restaurant. So both were learning a lot about the barbecue trade. And then in about 2010, Gary decided he was going to open up his own barbecue joint. And Mac's restaurant was called Uncle John's Barbecue. And so he did a lot of prodding. He had to do a lot of convincing to ask his godfather, Mac, to divulge the secrets, to divulge the recipes. With Mac's blessing, he opened up his own Uncle John's Barbecue. And it's been 8 years since that opened. And to my mind, Gary Kennebrew's Uncle John's Barbecue is one of the great Southside Chicago barbecue restaurants, I think, of the last decade.
Now, I want to just fly to Chicago and go eat his barbecue. That's number one. But why is it that so few North Chicagoans even know that Southside Barbecue exists?
Chicago is really a tale of two cities. You know, I think people who are operating on the north side of Chicago, they stay in the north side. People who are on the south side, they stay in there on the south side. And there's really not a lot of commingling around. You know, there's a lot of reasons behind that. Housing segregation, certainly. I mean, it's really too much to even dive into now. What we do know is that people sort of stay in their own social silos. You know, what's really surprising to me is that even amongst my friends who are big foodies, a lot of them have only sort of a peripheral awareness of what Southside Chicago barbecue is. And I'm talking about these are specifically my friends who live on the north side of Chicago.
You know, it's so interesting because in LA, we have become a population that is willing to travel into areas that are out of our bubble for food. I mean, that seems to be the one thing that will get us out of our neighborhoods. And yet, for something to become like Instagrammable, often it takes somebody like, let's say, Bledsoe's, which is a Texas barbecue that was opened in Compton. And then when they opened on La Brea in Mid-City, then all of a sudden more and more people were discovering it. Mm. Has a Southside barbecue restaurant ever tried to open on the north side?
There is. And I think the one example that we talk about in the story is this one place called Honey One Barbecue. And it's open on the north side of Chicago. And they've been open since, I think, for at least 12, 13, 14 years. And so amongst the really intense like foodies, if there's a message board here for local Chicago food geeks here, and it's on that message board, they talk about Honey One Barbecue all the time. They're big fans of it. But they're really still just a minority. I spoke with one of the owners there, Robert Adams Jr. His father, Robert Adams Sr., is the pitmaster there, and they do really fine barbecue. He was telling me that when they were still on the north side of Chicago, they were experiencing a lot of complaints from neighbors about the smell. They were getting a lot of citations from like the health departments. They were getting bothered a lot. And he told me that he had a lot of friends who were also running these sort of businesses on the south side of Chicago, and they weren't getting nearly as much complaints, if any complaints about it. So, you know, I think what he was trying to say was that implicitly that the neighborhood didn't really embrace them. They never really became part of the neighborhood fabric. And eventually, a couple of years ago, they decided to move down to the south side of Chicago to this neighborhood called Bronzeville. Lo and behold, they've been flourishing ever since. There's a lot of sort of between the lines reading there. Make of that what you will.
So is Southside barbecue something that's thriving, or do you feel like it's going to die out as these men age?
It's hard to say. A lot of these pitmasters are getting up in age. Max Sevier, who I talked about in the story and who I talked about earlier, he died a couple of years ago at the age of 70. James Lemons, he was the proprietor of this really famous barbecue joint called Lem's Barbecue. He died 6 months later in December of 2015. He was 87. It's really not a young man's game. Even Gary Kennebrew, who I feature in the story, I ask him, you know, who do you think is going to take over? And two of his sons, one of them is a doctor, one of them is in medicine. He's got another son who's in trucking, who he's trying to convince him to take over this business. It's really hard to say. I think if I were to estimate, there's probably no more than 20 people in Chicago, and really, I guess 20 people in the whole world, who have the facility to operate an aquarium smoker. So that number was way, way higher 30, 40 years ago, at least triple that, if not more than that. So is it declining? Definitely yes. Can it go away? Who knows? What needs to happen is that just more folks need to come to Chicago and experiencing this themselves. You know, Arthur Bryant, not a lot of people knew about Arthur Bryant, you know, however many 50, 60 years ago. And now people are traveling to Kansas City just to have that barbecue. You can say the same thing about Rodney Scott. Rodney Scott, you know, in Charleston, South Carolina. I think people just need to know about this barbecue. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote this story is that I wanted people outside Chicago to know about this really peculiar, curious, and totally delicious style of barbecue. People should just be able to try this before it goes away forever, and I hope it doesn't go away forever.
That's Kevin Pang, editor of The Takeout. His recent article for Savour is called Chicago is a City Divided by Barbecue. Find a link to it on the Good Food website. In a moment, I'm joined by proud native daughter of Los Angeles, Chef Naisha Arrington. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Yeah, my earliest memories are standing on a chair next to her in the kitchen. How's the fastest way I can do this? You know, she taught me how to like smash the garlic or like put it in a bowl and shake it and loosen up the skin. So I think those are really the things that ingrained myself to understand how to produce food quickly and also understand how to develop flavor.
That's Naisha Arrington talking to me about her grandmother. Every once in a while, a chef comes along with food that isn't just Instagrammable and intellectually interesting, but craveable and reflective of a diverse worldview. I've been talking to Naisha about how she's keeping those things in tension at her restaurant Native right here in Santa Monica. Hi there.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming and congratulations on your new place.
Thank you.
It's really become a cliche, but it's true that in order to do sound levels, we actually ask guests what they had for breakfast.
Yeah.
So what did you have for breakfast this morning?
So I had a kimchi stew with egg inside that I floated and it sort of scrambled in and made the broth really delicious. And it was super spicy and it was like perfect to jumpstart the busy week ahead.
So when you make a stew like that, what broth do you start with?
Generally, I start with like sauteed garlic, little ginger, sesame, and then I'll use like a chicken stock, veal stock, half and half. And then I add some like halved scallion whites and some kimchi and the juice and bring that to a simmer. And then just float some scrambled egg inside.
Oh, God,
it was so good.
Sounds really good. So is that a typical breakfast for you? Do you go back to Korean roots for breakfast?
I have to say, not every morning. I'm just a big fan of breakfast in general. Like the Korean side of my family, it left an impression on my palate to understand a people through food. Being African American and, you know, not getting those flavors at school or like maybe not every day at my parents' house, you know. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's like I love salty bacon with like scrambled eggs or, you know, but as a chef, I have to say, like, I always have kimchi or like rice and things in my pantry because they don't go bad. And like sometimes when I buy stuff, like I have all of the intent to like make meals for the week. And then, you know, I get busy at the restaurant and don't end up doing it half the time. Fortunately today, when I went into the restaurant, my cooks, they made that for me. So they were really excited to like have that.
And that's adorable.
It was amazing. Like I came in, they were like, Chef, we made this kimchi stew. You know, happy Tuesday. And I'm like, this is literally amazing.
In many ways, you are a native daughter of L.A. Is this the source of your restaurant's name?
It absolutely is. Native, it really resonates in the nucleus of thought of celebrating neighborhoods and cultures of Los Angeles from a global perspective, but really just from an L.A. perspective in that I feel like Los Angeles is getting its time to celebrate culture through food.
And you yourself come from a diverse multicultural background.
Yes.
What are some of the earliest food memories that sort of marked your palate?
So for myself, I was always in the kitchen with my grandmother. She was a Korean immigrant, and my earliest food memories are being her sous chef, you know? And, you know, she was the type of woman who had, you know, not like mayo and mustard and ketchup on the side of the fridge and like hot sauces. It was like glass jars of like random different fermented sauces and like all these delicious things. And I remember falling in love with sauce, just like adding that to any dish and having it elevated so much. But for her, I have to say, even as a all-encompassing understanding of culture through food, it was sitting at the dinner table and having like all of this, almost like banchan, you know, like having the green leaf lettuce, having steamed rice, having kimchi, having octopus, having the doenjang, like, and that whole like crossing of arms over the table and great conversation and, you know, sitting on the floor with our no shoes, because she was very adamant about us taking our shoes off in the house and not touching the walls and just, you know, very strict Korean mindset.
Both your parents are artist musicians.
Yeah.
And you were involved in the art world for a while. You did a lot of different kinds of art. Can you talk a bit about the difference in process between being an artist and being a chef?
Yes, it's my favorite subject. And I feel that it takes a certain type of brain, really, and mindset to be a chef. And also, you know, using food as a medium for self-expression, like that in itself is something that is very special. You're dealing with a medium that is perishable, you know, that you are articulating to another set of hands to create and make that like intangible thing tangible and teach someone to put as much love and passion and care into a product to create something so beautiful that, you know, it might not be like intricate, but it touches the soul. And that's really what I always aim for when I create dishes, is it should have that je ne sais quoi, like, why is this so delicious? This makes me feel like from a hug from the inside. It's really fun to like celebrate the growers and use that for my inspiration of art on a plate. When I'm actually painting on a literal canvas, you know, that's pure self-expression. That's, you know, I'm using colors as my palette.
Your plates often look like palettes.
Yes. Yes. I love to use like temperature and texture and color. Like I'm really about the bold, bright color, even if it's muted, if it's like a grayscale or if it's like, you know, different tone. You know, I always approach a plate like a palette, like it's a canvas, and sort of create these layers, right, of like experience, really. You know, the crunch is going to come in at the right time. You know, this broth is going to come in at the right time and hydrate, you know, this crispy quinoa or puffed wild rice or what have you. And it's going to create an experience on your palate. But it's my favorite thing, the plating and the curation of it and celebrating the story of the person who grew it and, you know, being a steward of the land in that respect and bringing something to light by just adding, you know, my chefy brain on it and creating something really unique. You know, I feel like when you create a plate, that's something that's enjoyed on many levels for the person enjoying it. You know, it's nourishing your body, and it's also a piece of artwork that you eat and is consumed right away, and then it goes away. You know, it doesn't live on a wall. It lives in your soul and your memory.
So who was your mentor here in L.A.?
Well, I've had many in different respects and different buckets that I've been in, but I have to say, Josiah Citrin, he has been a person that has resonated so deep within me because I truly saw what he was aiming to accomplish at his restaurant at Melis, where I was a junior sous chef for 2 years. And, you know, I was coming up and, you know, he was the first Michelin-starred chef I worked for. And he saw something in me very young that I didn't think I knew I had, you know, and it was just this insatiable thirst for intelligent thinking, right, and being efficient and developing the most flavor at that restaurant. I remember the first day I staged, Brendan Collins was the chef. And I remember I just read Kitchen Confidential and like it was like 2005, 2006 maybe. And I remember a plate like flying past my face. I felt this like energy like within me that I was like, I'm glued for the rest of my life. Like I loved that rally before dinner service, you know, where like you hear the pan, it's clinking, you hear the blenders stirring, being like almost like a kitchen whisperer. Like, you know, when you walk in the kitchen, just by hearing the viscosity of a blender, like what's going on there? You know, I know without even looking that that guy is making sunchoke velouté or things like that. But I remember I was on the line and I felt like I don't belong here. I hadn't done anything like that before. And I came in as like the lead cook, you know, where I'm navigating an entire board of tickets, of 8-course tickets, and cooking proteins from all over the world that I've never cooked. But I realized as chefs, that's something that is ingrained within you, just knowing how to manipulate product, how to bring things to life. And he always says, even to this day, I always know the good chefs by their staff meals that they make. And I remember I'd always, like, rush and, like, make sure all my mise en place was set up and, like, my station was perfect and I didn't want for anything. And I always try to strive that thought in my cooks is you should be standing at your station with nothing to do by the time service comes around. It's not fun to cook under that pressure of, like, oh, I need to do this, oh, I need to do that. But I'd always take that time to, like, challenge myself to, like, make the most phenomenal family meals. And I'd make, you know, fresh-made biscuits, you know, I'd make dumplings and, like, all these things where, like, it wasn't an afterthought. Like, I really wanted to let that out, whatever was in me that was, like, you know, that creative process.
That's Naisha Arrington, executive chef of Native here in Santa Monica. On Friday, March 9th, she'll be co-hosting the All-Star Women's Masters Dinner at the All-Star Chef Classic at LA Live. Visit allstarchefclassic.com to learn more. And now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's here to talk about the LA Times new Koreatown guide. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
Yeah, the LA Times published something called The Ultimate Guide to Koreatown, where to find the best restaurants, bars, spas, shopping, and more.
I would be the restaurant part of that.
I imagine that you are. But I think it's really interesting because it shows that we eaters are spending so much time there. Maybe we should know about all of these other things.
Yeah, well, we've all been watching the Olympics on TV. And we've all been seeing Korea, and some of us have been sort of more excited about, you know, what sort of plates they might be showing in their occasional sojourns to Seoul or to, you know, Pyeongchang outside the compound. And we're lucky enough to live in a city whose Korean neighborhood, and specifically Korean restaurant neighborhood, is the best in the world outside Korea.
Yeah, really, really, really lucky. So let's talk about restaurants. I don't think I need to ask you where I should get my hair done in Koreatown. You do that deep dive into Koreatown eating anyway every year.
Right.
Why don't you give me five places that aren't necessarily for special occasion, but just five places that should be in our regular restaurant rotation?
Well, there's so many places that should be in the rotation. We've talked about most of these on the show anyway. I revisited a place called 8th Street Sundae, and Sundae is Korean blood sausage, which you would think would be sort of one-dimensional. It turns out that there are actually maybe 8 or 9 blood sausage specialists in Koreatown. That's something that you always know about, but until you spend a lot of time in the neighborhood, you don't really realize there's not just one place that specializes in the beef soup, Seolleongtang. There's 15.
Blood sausage. A lot of people are put off by the name.
Right.
And the color. But in fact, if you get past those two things, when you put it in your mouth, it's incredibly mild.
Yeah, it is mild. It's not super funky. It's not even as funky as the French blood sausages you might have had. It's mostly unspiced. As with a lot of Korean food, the spice comes from whatever you might choose to season it with. And you can get Sundae bokkeum. Bokkeum means saute, but that means sauteed with like onions and peppers and a slug of chili sauce and garlic and other good things. I'd recommend that, and I'd also recommend the regular grilled sausage, with or without the steamed intestines on the side. Soon tofu is another dish that I think has existed in Korea forever, but I think its current popularity in Korea may have started here with a restaurant called Beverly Soon Tofu that's been here since the 80s and does a really good version of the soup, which is basically very fresh tofu cooked in a broth. And you can get a mild version with a clam broth, or you can get it spiced to the point where you won't be able to stand yourself in the morning.
And it's volcanically bubbling.
It's volcanically bubbling. Like so many things in Koreatown,
I don't even know how they get it to the table that hot.
But there are 10 different kinds of restaurants that all do. There must be 100 and 150 like superheated pod restaurants in Koreatown alone. I mean, Seonnangdan, which we talked about on the show, this has this almost four-dimensional short rib stew that comes in a broth that's as hot as you want it to be, and you want it to be really hot. That also comes in one of those superheated
bubbly things.
or one of my very favorite restaurants in Koreatown that I'm not sure we've talked about before, called the Buil, B-U-I-L, or Buil Sangjitang, which specializes in this soup. They have it a lot of other places, that has a whole stuffed game hen in the middle of it.
This isn't a soup for one.
It is a soup for one. It's a really tiny hen.
Okay.
And it's stuffed with sticky rice and ginseng and a really sort of incredible dose of garlic.
A perfect soup for this time of year.
Yeah, it's really healthful. There's a variation with shaved deer antler, which I've never actually gotten around to trying.
That must be very medicinal.
It is. This is medicinal, too. It's a health soup.
That happens to be delicious.
That happens to be delicious. And you sprinkle salt onto it. It's basically unsalted. And the levels of flavor just keep coming up with every bite. I couldn't recommend it more highly. Some other places that I've revisited that I like are Chunju Hanil Kwan, which is a full-service restaurant that has so many different things on the menu, but it's famous for its version of bure chike, which is a soup. It's a spicy soup that has convenience food in it. It has packaged ramen. It has spam. It has what look like Vienna sausages. It has sliced hot dogs. And it's supposed to be like the surplus stuff that people could buy at the army bases in Seoul and bring home and make into a Korean soup.
People love that.
People love that stuff. Some people I know like will refuse to eat it.
It's a bit too much for me. Like I can take like 5 bites and then I get just overwhelmed.
I think there's that like extra jolt of MSG from yeah. the ramen noodles. It's just like...
Well, every item that you mentioned...
Yeah. And one last place I thought I'd mention is a place called Yukdaejang, which is a newish place. It's the first American outpost of a pretty large chain based in Seoul. And it specializes in Yukdaejang, which is a spicy scarlet beef soup that has cellophane noodles in it. And I think the thing that makes it stand out is the purity of the beef flavor in the broth. It's spectacular.
Are the noodles those yam thread noodles?
I'm not sure whether they're yam thread or rice thread. They're the chewy kind that are hard to bite through.
Wonderful. Well, I think many of us look forward to working our way through this ultimate guide to Koreatown.
I hope you do. We're lucky to have it here.
We are lucky to have it here. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
So good to be here.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. We've been talking about a few of his favorite restaurants in Koreatown. They were all featured in the LA Times new Koreatown guide. Find a link to it on the Good Food website and text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. It's Oscar week, and some of the nominated best films are all about food. We're talking about them when we come back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. As food obsession has moved into mainstream media, it should be no surprise that movies are the subject more and more in a very considered way. The Oscars are tomorrow. Have you thought about how many of the nominated films are really about food? I've been talking about a few with Mother Jones food columnist Tom Philpott and Helen Rosner, the new food correspondent for The New Yorker. Hello, the two of you.
Hi, Evan.
Hi, Evan.
So the movies this year that most struck me about food being central to character and plot development are Get Out, The Shape of Water, and Phantom Thread. Helen, I understand that you can't watch scary movies, so you didn't see Get Out.
I actually have seen it since Tom and I last spoke. I overcame my fear.
Well, I know that Mother Jones had an article, and now the LA Times also has a recent article that talk about milk being a placeholder for white supremacy.
Yes.
Tom, could you speak to that a little bit and how it plays into the film?
Well, I just found it to be just a really chilling scene. Yeah, we should issue a spoiler alert here for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. But at the end of the movie, after the character played by Allison Williams is sort of outed as this kind of vampire-like character sucking the souls of black men, there's a scene where she is at her computer checking out Facebook and other profiles of potential future victims. And she's having some cereal, but instead of combining the milk with the cereal, she's got the cereal, which is colored Fruit Loops, and the milk separate. And she's, you know, just sort of crunching away at her cereal and taking sips out of her milk. And I think it's a fairly straightforward metaphor that we're invited to think about. It's sort of the symbology going on there that she's sort of maintaining this this power structure with white folks at the top. By insisting on separating these things.
I mean, it's become very clear that the director, Jordan Peele, did not make any choices without intense meaning behind them. Almost every aesthetic component of the movie, whether it's action or background scenes or whatever, plays into this overall narrative and allegory and the whole construction. So of course, I mean, the milk is so sinister. And of course, it's white and it's being kept away from the rainbow of Fruit Loops. So you have, like, as Tom said, this obvious distinction. But milk is also such a fraught substance. It's, you know, it represents childhood and nurturing and purity. And it also so quickly can become such an intensely sinister thing. I thought it was phenomenally affecting. It was a hilarious and terrifying moment.
There's also a conversation going on now about how the government daily requirement of a certain amount of milk every day is actually a racist policy because so many citizens who live in America are lactose intolerant. Jordan Peele himself does not drink any dairy. So there's also that level of symbolism and the fact that it's been white milk has been taken on as a symbol by white supremacists, apparently.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty well known that you don't need to drink milk to get enough calcium. And so it's kind of weird that it is its own food group and gets all this sort of government propaganda around it when it isn't all that necessary of a food.
There's something about the sinister sound of crunching that was both used really effectively in Get Out and in The Phantom Thread with the breakfast scene with toast. I'd love to hear your two takes on it.
The toast in Phantom Thread is the fourth star of the movie. I mean, I think that it's been so interesting. I've now seen Phantom Thread a handful of times, and every time I revisit it, I'm so surprised how different the movie is from what it was marketed as. Because it's actually this incredibly funny, weird, kind of beautiful romantic comedy, more than it is sort of a dour, windswept sort of prestige film about a fashion designer. And the toast, the act of buttering toast and the incredible noises that that makes and the irritation that that causes for the character played by Daniel Day-Lewis is, I think, the first hint that we get that this movie is going to be really weirdly funny. Because it turns out it's hilarious, this moment of him just being horrified by this crunching noise and a woman sitting at his breakfast table obliviously slathering butter on his toast and driving him into deeper and deeper irritated agonies.
To the great delight of his sister Cyril, who has, at that point of the movie, so much of the female power in his life.
Absolutely. Who wants to see this woman gone. And then, of course, she is. And the plot of the movie begins when she's replaced by another character played by Vicky Creeps named Alma, who also winds up having a scene with toast at the breakfast table in which she pushes back. And that takes us right to the core of food as, and I wrote a story about this for The New Yorker, food as the language of power within this movie. That almost every moment where Reynolds, Woodcock, and Alma push and pull at each other within their relationship happens over food, whether it's at the table or in the kitchen. And the way that she handles the toast buttering incident and his displeasure is so different from the woman who is dismissed as his girlfriend in the beginning of the movie. It sets us off on such a wonderful path.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers, but as their relationship moves along, the way she uses butter as a moment of defiance to stake out her independence from the Daniel Day-Lewis character.
It's really powerful. And it's so resonant, too. I mean, one of the things I find very gratifying is that food, as I've written before, food is so often a metaphor for love and for happiness and nurturing and fulfillment. And it was thrilling and exciting and uncomfortable in a really fun way to see food used as a tool of aggression and manipulation instead of just another metaphor for happiness.
As it often is within a family context.
Absolutely.
So let's take that toast and let's move to The Shape of Water, where the morning routine is just fascinating as a way to set up the character of the two human main characters.
And Eliza, that, yeah.
Yeah. And that two side buttered toast.
Yeah. So I saw that film. I saw it the first time and got sucked into the plot and didn't think that much about food. I mean, you can't not think about it because it's so knit through the movie. But the second time I saw it, after reading Helen's essay, just before talking to Helen for my podcast, I saw it again, and food is everywhere. And the Octavia Spencer, she has these sort of soliloquies in the movie where she's just sort of bantering with her friend and narrating her kitchen adventures to please her husband and how he doesn't listen. He just, you know, just gobbles it up. And one of the things that she mentions is that she buttered his toast for him. And then she amplifies it by saying, on both sides. And he still didn't take any note or thank her or appreciate her. So this character is constantly talking about the way that she uses food at home as a nurturing device. And it's completely rejected by her husband. And his insensitivity later comes up as a plot point in the movie. So it's just really, really nicely done.
And then her sidekick, the character played by Sally Hawkins, is mute. And so when we see her morning breakfast routine and the interaction she has with helping out her neighbor, it basically, watching her make this food in that setting tells us who she is.
Yeah, it really does give us insight into who she is as a character. The character of Eliza is so fascinating because she does not have speech as a way to communicate. And so she's established through a number of really thoughtful angles in the beginning of the movie. We're introduced to the physicality and the colors of her home. We're introduced to her sexuality right away as a part of her character. And then comes the making of her breakfast, which also becomes part of her lunch and also becomes part of the way that she has an ongoing, intimate, almost familial relationship with her next door neighbor, who's sort of her sidekick and mentor throughout the movie and also serves as the narrator. But basically offering food to people, whether it's preparing it or literally feeding them or simply handing something over in a brown paper bag, becomes a really important way that she communicates with others.
Let's talk for a moment about the pies.
Oh, they're so lurid.
First of all, the whole production design of this movie is just fascinating and alternately comforting and really threatening. And to me, these pies were just more on the threatening side, that the color of the Jell-O is sort of livid in a way.
You know, the whole sham of this pie shop that is supposed to be like this local corner pie shop, you know, maybe populated by a sort of a down-home guy from the South who, you know, knows everyone and is very friendly. And he turns out to be from Iowa, doesn't have an accent, not a very nice guy. He handles the fact that one of the characters has a crush on him just as horribly as can be. This sort of vile-looking key lime pie is just a perfect amplification of that. Of course, the pie at the pie shop would be disgusting because, you know, Key lime pie is great. It's, you know, basically a curd product. It's a delicious lime curd instead of this sort of just artificial looking disgusting jello.
Yeah, so fascinating. I would love to continue talking to you too about this subject, but the two of you do have a longer conversation that our listeners can tune into if they wish more discussion.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I've been talking to Mother Jones food columnist Tom Philpott and Helen Rosner, food correspondent for The New Yorker. For more of their thoughts about the Oscars and food, check out the recent episode of the Mother Jones podcast called Bite. It's on Stitcher and Apple Podcasts. After the break, an intimate look at the life and legacy of cookbook author Paula Wolfert. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
She just always wanted to understand, and that kind of love of delicious flavors and this endless thirst for knowledge drove her on this 40-year quest to keep finding incredible recipes.
Paula Wolfert may be the most influential cookbook author you've never heard of, writes Emily Kaiser Thelen. I heard of her. She was one of my culinary aunties, a huge mentor. Paula's diagnosis of dementia in 2013 prompted Emily to document Paula's legacy in a biography called Unforgettable. This week, the book won for Best Literary Food Writing at the awards ceremony for the International Association of Culinary Professionals.
I first met Paula at a food conference. As a groupie, I just approached her and said hi and looked agog and then ran away. But I got to know her when I got to be her editor at Food & Wine magazine, where she was a longtime contributor. When my editor said, hey, would you like to edit the master column? You'd be editing Paula Wolfert. My jaw hit the floor. She had been a hero of mine my whole life. And it's a fun story. The column was originally built around Julia Child and Marcella Hazan and Jacques Pepin, and by the time I inherited it, it was Jacques, Jean-Georges von Grischten, and Paula. And for the first two, my boss, Tina Ulaki, gave me the numbers of their personal assistants, but they gave me Paula's home phone number. And when I called her number, she picked up, and she said, well, if you're going to be my editor, the first thing you need to know about me is I can't write my way out of a paper bag, which, of course, as you and I both know, is not true at all. But it was the start of a wonderful collaborative relationship.
So when you were just in the groupie stage, what was the book that really spoke to you?
It's fun because she has so many, but the one that absolutely grabbed me is her first, Couscous and Other Good Foods from Morocco. I've never seen a book like it before or since. It was so immersive and romantic, but also so rigorous, and the recipes were so stellar. And any Moroccan-inspired dish you come across, you can know was touched by that book.
First of all, how did this girl, young woman from Flatbush, who grew up on a regimen dominated by 50s diet food, end up traveling the world and becoming an authority on these flavors that were relatively foreign to American eaters?
Yeah, so she grew up, as you say, in this very non-food-centric household, but she had a grandmother who was from the Balkans, who she spent a year with when she was five in 1943, at the sort of height of World War II. Who had a victory garden, who cooked fresh eggplant right out of that garden on the stove and made these very traditional, to Paula's mind, ordinary but layered dishes that, from reading up on food science, I think really seared themselves in her mind. And she had a really close bond with this grandmother, and I think in her most sort of primitive parts of her mind came to associate love with these delicious, real, truly Mediterranean flavors. Because the Balkans, you don't think of it as a Mediterranean region, but it's a crossroads of many Mediterranean cultures. So I think that kind of planted a seed. But how do you, that doesn't automatically spark an 8-book cookbook career. For other reasons, she was blessed with an unrelenting drive. Someone put it to me really well recently. They said her fear of getting it wrong was the only thing stronger than her incredible fears themselves. She's been riddled with anxiety her whole life, but she kind of coped with that anxiety by researching the hell out of things.
It's so fascinating and poignant to realize how riddled with fear she was when she was such an indomitable traveler and immerser into cultures that she knew nothing about during a time when there was no internet. Traveling was a completely different experience than it is now. Could you speak a bit about the way that she was able to ingratiate herself into homes of cooks who were often servants?
I think I wasn't alone in having this misconception that traveling abroad to get people's recipes is a relatively friendly, cozy, romantic affair. Like, who wouldn't want to share their recipe for their family's best bread? But I think people actually don't like to share their recipes. They're very possessive of them and competitive and guarded. And it would only be natural, especially if you're some, you know, Moroccan dada or a real cook servant. Your recipes are your livelihood. You're not about to give them away to some random Jewish lady from Brooklyn. She developed all kinds of canny tricks for getting people to trust her. And her fundamental rule was, I'm here to connect with this person as a human. I'm not here to exploit them for their recipe. And she had all these wonderful ways of doing that. She always made sure to bring a gift wherever she went, even if that meant lugging huge cans of Vermont maple syrup across southwest France to give those out as thank you presents to the various chefs she met. When she knew she was in the presence of someone who really knew what she was they were doing, they formed this really kind of otherworldly bond.
So she's this person who has this incredible, voracious need to connect, both intellectually, technically, and humanly. But she also grew up at this very particular time and was with these men who allowed her to create homes in these far-flung places, in which she ended up being with people who are like who's who of like the Beatnik era, and then who's who of the James Beard, Craig Claiborne, Pierre Frany era of American cooking. It's like her life was marked by these profound moments.
Yeah, she really was a fly on the wall at some incredible gatherings. Her first husband, Michael Wolfert, whom she married at the mature age of 19, in 1957, was an aspiring beat novelist who counted among his very close friends Gregory Corso and Peter Orlovsky. So she was buddies with Allen Ginsberg, and his father was a friend of James Beard's editor. So when Paula got into food, it was through the Wolfert family that she was introduced to Beard, but it was through her own pluck that she proved herself to Beard as a capable cook and worthy member of his innermost circle, whom he sort of farmed out as a caterer at various cocktail parties.
So let's talk about these a couple of these books, because they're wildly different yet incredibly similar in her perfectionist teaching of these cuisines. So you mentioned the couscous book, which happened when she was living in Tangier. But then how did the Southwest France book come about? Because I feel like a lot of the people who were cookbook devotees of the time, that's where they discovered her, people who were Julia Child fans and who sort of were interested in a more Western, a more European kind of cooking.
One of the many things that impresses me about her career is that the cookbooks, she has a reputation as something of a free spirit who wrote these books on a whim, but there's a real narrative arc just to the books themselves, and each one got more and more specific as she tried to position something new with every outing. Couscous, you would have thought, made her reputation, but in fact, it wasn't hugely recognized at the time. It was almost overlooked, and in fact, came close to going completely out of print. And she herself stayed in Tangier, wasn't that interested in pursuing a food career, sort of was still casting about for what she wanted to do. It wasn't until the later 70s when she and her second husband, the crime writer Bill Beyer, decided to move back to New York that she realized she should find a career for herself. And she came back to the States and realized she had a very small but devoted following of women home cooks who wanted to be taught the recipes from Couscous, and she started going on this sort of cooking teaching circuit, which is became a big pathway for how she kind of propagated her ideas, sort of like a traveling missionary. And at the same time, I mean, the late 70s was a really ripe time to land in New York. If you were thinking about a career in food writing, that was the real birth of the American food movement as we now know it. There were half a dozen food magazines opening up and new cooking schools opening up across the country, and a real wave of interest sparked by a lot of different reasons in good food and food of tradition. And Paula is always apt to cast things in the sort of passive voice, like, people were just taken with me. They wanted to know who was this woman who knew so much about Moroccan food. But she was also voraciously curious and competitive and out there to prove herself. And she saw everybody in the late 70s was captivated by Nouvelle Cuisine, which was centered around Paris and a bit to Lyon. So she looked for something that wasn't covered, and she discovered it in the foods of Southwest France.
So let's talk about Paula's diagnosis. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2013, which was the impetus for this project, Unforgettable, which started out on Kickstarter. Is she still able to cook? Is she still fighting her way through using recipes and aroma and flavor?
It's interesting. Alzheimer's has, in very unexpected ways, grounded her and resolved a lot of her struggles with anxiety and trying to find a place in the world. For better or for worse, it has forced her, as she says, to live in the now and to make the best of what she has. But because of the way Alzheimer's sort of goes at the brain, and one of the first things it goes after is your hippocampus, which is what allows you to process new information. I never really thought about this, but even for someone as established and experienced as Paula, cooking is always a kind of conversation between you and the food, and you're always having to process new information, and it's very hard for her to do, and it's kind of stripped of a lot of the joy it used to have. And also, not only because of the processing challenges, but because flavor and aroma are very diminished. It's a real hallmark of all kinds of dementia that those are two of the first things to go. But she has this entirely new relationship with food where she is fascinated by the ways she can use it as medicine. So she is a huge fanatic devotee of the ketogenic diet and is always in flooding my inbox with new articles about the benefits of omega-3-rich wild-caught salmon and grass-fed beef and plant-based diet. And one of her favorites is bulletproof coffee. So in a fun way, she's as obsessive and fanatical as ever, but in this very different direction.
That was Emily Kaiser-Thelen. Her award-winning book is Unforgettable, The Bold Flavors of Paula Wolpert's Renegade Life. The culinary biography features over 50 of Paula's classic recipes. That's it for our show today. Just remember that early bird signups for KCRW's annual pie contest are in full swing. Visit kcrw.com/pie to sign up and learn more. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Find us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review if you like the show. Thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.